Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Thursday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy our show.
This story was first published on July 31st of 2016, under the headline, "Truck Bombs Doomed the Cause of Newspaper Striking Unions." Here we go. In a retrospective article many years later, Oregonian columnist Steve Dunn wrote that the shotgun ambush of newspaper manager Donald Newhouse by some unknown lurker outside of his basement window was the moral turning point in the newspaper's struggle with its unions. That's not entirely true. There was another turning point, a much more important one, actually. It had happened just 2 months after the union members went out on strike. At that time, the newspaper management was hurting badly. Most Portlanders were pro-union. Union members were going door to door asking everyone to cancel their subscriptions, and tens of thousands of them were doing it. The only bright spot for the Oregonian's absentee owner, New Yorker Sam Newhouse, was that he'd gotten the competing newspaper, the Oregon Journal, to join the Oregonian in all labor negotiations, meaning that the Journal had been sucked into the fight by, essentially, treaty obligations. Had that not been the case, hundreds of thousands of Portlanders would almost certainly have just simply switched papers, and the strike would have been over. As it was, the unions realized that asking residents to give up their daily newspaper was asking rather a lot of them, so they pooled their resources and expertise and launched a third newspaper in Portland, at first a weekly, and then, as it became clear that this would not suffice, a daily. It was called the Portland Reporter. It was excellent, if a bit thin, and until its closure for financial reasons in 1964, it helped a great deal. Would that have been enough? We'll never know, because one of the stereotypers, the obsolete workers whose walkout over equipment upgrades had started the whole thing, got impatient. Which is apparently why, at midnight on January 31st, 1960, a series of 10 colossal dynamite blasts shook sleepers awake in Oregon City. Stereotyper Levi McDonald had hired some young fellows, given them dynamite and fuses, and sent them out into the night to apply a little direct pressure to some of the trucking companies that had had the temerity to continue doing business with the Oregonian. 10 trucks had been blown up. Luckily, no one had been hurt. Now, it's important to understand that in 1960, the vast majority of people in Portland had lived through or participated in the Second World War. The way to win the hearts and minds of people who have experienced total war is not to show oneself as the side most willing to resort to such extreme methods as truck bombs. Furthermore, the recklessness of the action was appalling. What if somebody had been in one of those trucks or working nearby? Unlikely, yes, but unlikely things do happen sometimes. The next day, the sun came up on a completely different world. Now, when the union reps knocked on a Portlander's door and asked him or her to cancel his or her subscription, the Portlander's perception of the whole affair would be different. It wasn't local guys getting stiffed by a New York mogul. It was bomb-throwing union thugs fighting with a New York mogul. It's not hard to understand what that change did to the union canvassers' success rate. It is entirely possible that McDonald was discreetly ratted out by fellow union members, who realized that he'd probably just lost them the war, figured their only hope was to show the world that the bombings had been a rogue member's freelance action and not an official union operation. It's also possible, if rather unlikely, that, as union members afterwards claimed, that the whole thing was a false flag operation and that McDonald had been put up to it by the Oregonian. The union decried the bombings immediately, and even contributed $1,000 to the reward offered for the perpetrator's capture. But it wasn't enough. Essentially, the bombings turned a strike that had been on a relatively fast track toward a successful resolution, successful for the union, that is, into a losing stalemate that would drag on for 5 years. For Sam Newhouse, a 5-year fight was tolerable. He owned a big string of other newspapers, and revenue from them would prop up the temporarily money-losing Oregonian nicely. Plus, he had, with remarkable prescience, it has to be said, bought a very expensive strike insurance policy just before the whole mess broke out. But for the Oregon Journal, times were tough indeed. Remember, this was just a few years after the last member of the founding Jackson family, Maria, had died. Maria had tried to pass her stock in the newspaper on to the employees, but the three trustees in charge of her estate challenged the bequest in court and won, thereby essentially robbing the employees of their inheritance, and more importantly, leaving the trustees in control of the newspaper. It was the trustees who had made the deal to jointly negotiate labor contracts with the Oregonian, and it was soon very clear that the trustees, who were charged with caring for the entire Jackson estate, not just the newspaper, were far more likely than the employees would have been to regard the newspaper as a financial asset rather than a public trust. Now, having made and stuck with a labor negotiating deal that had brought the journal to the brink of insolvency, the trustees moved to subvert the other major bequest in Maria's will, the part that specifically prohibited them from selling it to Newhouse. With the journal facing bankruptcy and a union strike that they could blame for the situation, the trustees could now plausibly claim that they were faced with a choice of either honoring Maria's wishes and allowing the paper to fold, or selling to Newhouse. Surely no reasonable person would fault them for saving Maria's paper, even though it were necessary to flout her express wishes to do so, right? And so, in 1961, the trustees accepted an $8 million offer from Newhouse, and Portland became effectively a one-newspaper town. As for the strike, it petered out over the following several years. In 1963, the National Labor Relations Board ruled it illegal, and finally in the spring of 1965, the pickets called it quits, and both papers became open shops. Key sources in this story have included works by Caleb Deal, Jean Clare, and OregonEncyclopedia.org.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 550 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions, pulp-lit.com, a boutique publishing house owned and operated by yours truly, specializing in audiobook and multimedia editions of the work of the classic pre-war pulp writers. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license type CC by SA 4.0, which basically means you can do anything with the content you like, so long as you A, give me credit for it, and B, whatever you make is also released under a Creative Commons license. But if you need a waiver to either A or B, hit me up, fj@offbeatoregon.com. I've never said no yet to a request for a waiver of one of those conditions. They're generally there just to prevent me from accidentally authorizing the reuse of something I don't actually control the rights to. A good example might be a photograph used by special permission of the rights holder. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode? Email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every single weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.